Hello, welcome to Holden Village. Today is Friday, June 22nd, 2001, in the fireside room this afternoon. Dorothy Bass is the presenter. Today's session number is BAD 2001-05 and is titled Sabbath and Other Timely Practices. Let's listen in.
My name is Dorothy Bass, and I come here from Valparaiso, Indiana. And this topic is about time, and this session is about time. If you thought you were here to see Field of Dreams, that's at 5 o'clock. I'm planning to stay for that myself. The concern of my work overall in the series of five sessions that I've done this week is how the shape of our life and the kind of culture that we live in impacts on our yearning to live faithfully as Christian people. And I think a lot of us have that yearning, and some of us do a pretty good job of it. But I think also that almost everybody I know feels that there are factors about our society that make it extra hard to live as we wish we could live and as we feel called to live. So, and one of the main pressures is the pressure on our time. Do you agree? The sense that things move too fast, there's too much. And so I hope we can think together through that issue during this session. And let me start with a story that really is the beginning of my own interest in time and the life of faith. And this took place, I would say, about 16 years ago now. I know that because I was pregnant with John and Martha at the time that this happened. And Mark and I were out to dinner on Saturday night with two of our very good friends, all of us teachers. And we were whining. And we were saying, oh, tomorrow I have to grade 20 papers. And then the next person would say, well, I have to grade 30 papers. And the next person would say, well, I have to grade 40 papers. And in one sense, we were all complaining. But in another sense, there became a little bit of a boast. You know, and we'd sit around saying with friends, you hear it all the time, and I've done this, I know, to Joan this very day, how are you? Well, really busy. And is this it is a complaint. But is it also a little bit of a boast? Because we justify ourselves, which, you know, in Christian faith we're not really supposed to be doing. We justify ourselves by the amount of stuff that we do, right? Well, we sat there whining about how tomorrow we would be grading all these papers, and it suddenly hit me that if we were sitting around saying, well, you know, tomorrow I think I'll commit adultery, or tomorrow I think I'll take the name of the Lord in vain, or tomorrow I think I'll steal something, we wouldn't be boasting, right? In other words, we're talking about one of the basic commandments of the Ten Commandments, you know, basic moral guidance for Jewish life, for Christian life, and really, in a sense, often for public life. And here was one of the commandments that, however you interpret it, we simply hadn't even thought about since confirmation class. And it was right there. So that kind of piqued my interest in time and gave me my first inkling that perhaps our life, our faith tradition, our life as Christian people could help to guide us through the conundrums that we and indeed our whole society have with time. Lots of folks are interested in time today. It shows up as a cover story in Time and Newsweek every other year or so. There are lots of books, and for good reason. Social scientists tell us that people really are busier, working harder, doing more than ever before, except that there are a minority of others who have empty days, right? People who have, you might say, saved all their Sabbaths to the end of life, and who don't know how to use the free time that comes to them in retirement. It's not true of all retired people by any means, but some. And I think some people my age think, well, I'll save my Sabbath, so I'll get them later. We don't know that we're going to live that long, of course. Mm-hmm. Right? But we don't think about that either. That's another time pressure we don't like to think about. And of course, some people who are disabled or permanently unemployed that there's a sense in the biblical concept of Sabbath that the good life includes work. It's not simply a day of rest, it's 6 days shall you labor, and that's a good part of life, but also a day of rest. So we have too much to do, or we're out of balance with how we distribute what there is to be done. But another factor is also very important, I think, in our experience of time. And that is that many of the boundaries that used to help us live well in time or figure out what time it is are going. You're nodding. People, you know, at other vacation spots, people take along their cell phones and their computers. Right? And there are certain workers in our society who are never, for a day, apart from their work, right? Because of what technology makes possible. Similarly, as we move into a 24/7 global market, there are lots of people who, you know, the sense of even night and day being meaningfully differentiated is being structured out of existence. You with me on this? So that stockbrokers and the people who clean their offices and who type their memos are living out of sync with often their own body rhythms, with the rhythms of the other members of their household. This isolates us from one another. Okay. Of course, Sunday being different, or any day being particularly different from other days, is decreasing as the culture becomes more and more commercial. So the boundaries, the sense of shape of time is a problem, as well as how much we have to do and how well we distribute that. Okay. Even seasons. I mean, you've experienced seasons in Minnesota and here at Holden and other places, but almost everybody in the United States, except for the most poor, can have any kind of tropical fruit any day of the year. Right. Time there's a great sea and shapelessness of it, which to me says that if we don't find ways to put down anchors, we're going to be just kind of drifted along in this great formless sea, like little leaves on the tide, you know, just pushed along without any guidance. Now, there is a predominant cultural response to this to the problem that so many people experience with time, and that response is time management. Okay? In our public school system in Valparaiso, Indiana, which is not even one of the most fast-paced places in the world by any means, all fourth graders are given or are required to buy, my kids brought one like this, a day timer to keep track of their lives, fourth grade. In high school, when they enter high school, they're given a spiral-bound notebook, you know, a little bit bigger than this, about this size, but with all the days on it, and in the front, all the rules of life in the high school. And that's maybe no surprise, but they can't get a bathroom pass in the high school unless they have this book. And give it to that. The only way you can get a pass is to get your date book signed. Okay? So there, you know, there's a sense of that time management is one of the most important things they have to learn. And it worries me that it starts so young, especially in fourth grade. High school, I can see. I carry a date book. It's very important. I'm not against time management. I don't yet have a palm pile. Some people tell me these are helpful. There are lots of ways in which people prioritize what needs to be done. That's fine. However, I want to say this. Our problem with time can never be really solved by these kinds of devices, because our problem with time goes much deeper. It gets into these questions of self-justification. It gets into, I think, some of the most profound spiritual issues there are about who we are and whose we are, if we think we're justifying ourselves by how we live in time. A little bit of history. The clock, maybe you know this, I didn't know this till fairly recently. The clock was invented by Benedictine monks. Why? Because they want to keep up a schedule of prayer that goes at all hours for the sake of the world. And they invented a device which would ring the bell. The word bell is clocka in Latin. They wanted a device that ring the bell at the right time and call them to prayer. So in a sense, every time the clock summoned them, they were being summoned to remember their mortality, understand that time is God's. Okay. However, you take the same device, put up on this town steeple in the middle of the town square, okay, and it starts to govern the market. Then you make it starts to govern labor, okay, and civic life. And you make sure that everybody has a clock in their own home, which is set to the same time. And you have a synchronized society, which has some benefits, but increasingly through history since that time, I think the clock has been a device that works best within the economic realm, where it makes some sense, okay, but which can distort our lives in families, you know, where we're, 4-year-olds just won't necessarily go with the clock system, you know. And also in worship, you know, where people are watching, is it going to run 1 minute over? So that the clock, which makes a lot of sense in certain spheres of life, has moved into these other spheres of life. And I think dominated our consciousness more than we would wish, more than I would wish, anyway. And to our harm. Let me read a couple of quotes about, I'm trying to make a case here that ultimately time is a spiritual issue and not just a management issue, okay? Gulliver's Travel, right? 1726, right? Beginning of the commercial age, Gulliver is a merchant traveling the seas, and he gets shipwrecked, and here he is now in Lilliput, and all the little guys are looking at him, trying to figure out who he is, and one of the things they say is, what is that big gold thing hanging from his waist that keeps going tick-tock, tick-tock? Okay. And the Lilliputians say, we conjecture it is either some unknown animal or the god that he worships. But we're more inclined to the latter opinion because he assured us that he seldom does anything without consulting it. He says it pointed out the time for every action of his life. Okay? It's a comment, I think it's Swift's comment on the emerging industrial and commercial society. And here now, we strap them to our bodies. We're going to strap them to our bodies. All right. Another thing about clock time. The anthropologists have this interesting distinction between clock time and event time. Clock time, obviously, is this kind of time. But event time is the amount of time that it takes to do something in its wholeness and integrity. I like it especially with regard to worship. Okay. Just this is how long it takes to do a proper Eucharist service. We kind of do Eucharist that way at Holden. We take the time it takes to pass the peace and so on. But at home, services are so often on clock time. It would be a huge disaster if it went over by a small amount of time, okay? Okay, so that's probably what the clock does to it. Another thing is the sense that, especially once you get to the point, which we got to many years ago, that time is money. A lie, by the way, time is not money, you know? But you've got that complete overlap, then you're in a different kind of trouble. This is a quote from Bill Gates, okay? He was interviewed in Newsweek. He says, Melinda is Catholic, he's talking about his wife, this was shortly after they were married, or a couple years, I guess. Melinda is Catholic, goes to church, and wants to raise Jennifer that way. But she offered me a deal. If I start going to church, my family was Congregationalist, then Jennifer could be raised in whatever religion I choose. Gates admits that he is tempted because he would prefer his daughter have a religion that has less theology and all than Catholicism. but he's not yet taken up the offer. Just in terms of allocation of time resources, see financial metaphor, religion is not very efficient, he says. There's a lot more I could be doing on a Sunday morning. True, that is a reality for, you know, a lot of people in our own congregations at home probably think that way. One more story example of how this is a spiritual problem as opposed to simply a management problem. comes from the poet Noel Oxenhandler, trying to understand the impact of this 24/7 sea, the soup of time, the formless shape in the midst of which we live. She points out that every town has two institutions that are always open, and that where this the pale light, neon light, and a clerk behind a desk. And these are the emergency room and
Walmart.
Walmart is 7-Eleven. Okay. One is the arena of real need. Right? The other is the arena of creative need. You know, I just have to have a Coke in the middle of the night. I have to get some, you know, Fritos. Have the munchies, right? So it's open. But we lose track of what is the real need, you know, and what is the creative needs as we're drawn into this 24/7, really consumer and entertainment society. So things are at stake about even who we are. Who we are as human beings. A few other points about it being a spiritual issue. This, I don't know about your household or your life, but I mean, this is the arena of rage, blame, guilt, shame. Somebody's late. The level of emotion that a little bit of lateness stirs up suggests to me that there's something really deeper going on about whose time is what and so on. So that's, you know, this self-righteousness, those other people who don't use their time well. You know, we're good ones, we're good people, we use our time well. Those other people don't. And of course, a lot of cultural things, we don't realize how much this attitude comes from living in a commercial, industrial culture, which has been governed by the clock these several centuries already. And so we condemn other cultures even that don't use time well. Okay, second, just and this is probably the most important one. The sense amidst just mountains of journalism about time and social scientific studies and so on, what doesn't get mentioned is the thing which we actually in Christian worship and our Christian faith mention so often, which is that human time is limited, that we are mortal, that we are not going to have all the time in the world, that the outcome of our efforts is beyond our control, and that the number of days that we have, any of us has, is beyond our knowledge at this time. It's so often said, and I think it's true, that people who have faced death and come through that, or who have who believe that their own death will be not too distant from now, often treasure each day in a way that the rest of us might envy at times, this consciousness of the preciousness of a day. And yeah, I don't anticipate a near death, but I don't know that, do I? I mean, I may have less time than my friend who is dealing with cancer or something, right? So, and that's true of all of us, and it's a missing piece in our thinking about time. How do we, in a sense, let go of the idea that we can master time and let it live within its flow? Okay, live within its flow, and learn from the patterns that we inhabit whose time it is. Okay, now. I don't, I want to repeat, I do not criticize time management. I think that it's often a very useful thing, especially within the economic realm, where clocks have their function. Perhaps even for families, which is a quasi-economic, household economic realm. And in friendships, it helps to be able to know, I'll meet you on a certain time. Right? On the other hand, and that's fine. Date books are good for helping us with those things. However, I think that whole mindset can also lead us into mistaken notions of what time is. I got my own date book. The thing that concerns me about the date book is not that, I mean, and it's just so nice and empty here in June. It's just great here at Holden. It's not that I would live without this or do without it. It's the idea that time is flat. Time consists of empty boxes, which it is our right and duty to fill. That's what time is. It's a series of empty boxes, and we will fill them with our own accomplishment. You know, if you're important, you get to have a bigger date book, and you know. So, and that's what time is, and it's flat, and we fill it. And actually, the Christian notion, it's not often articulated, but I think it's true, is that indeed time is actually full. Time is full of stuff. Time is full of blessing, and time is full of festivals and seasons, and time is full of Sabbaths and work days, and time is full of saints' days and anniversaries. The time actually has a fullness and a shape to it, which is related to the shape of our life with each other and with God. So that's the shape we're going to get into in a moment, especially on Sabbath. But any comments so far on this analysis? Is this ringing true? Or you want to add any details or examples or objections? Or yes, David.
When you talk about time being full, I think of the phrase, and I've come to hate it, I'm just killing time.
Mm-hmm.
When we're in between things and we have some time, and we have a chance to use it for something, but we say I'm killing time, which is a violent kind of way to think about it, a wasteful way to think about 10 minutes of opportunity instead of
right.
10 minutes of destruction.
I know what you mean. You know, it occurs to me to tie that into this whole project of mastering time. Well, this isn't time I've mastered right here, this 10 minutes, so I'm gonna kill it. You know?
Yeah.
The other time that I've mastered, it's got its place in my little scheme for everything, then that time I can live with, but I can't live with this other time. Yeah. The other...
It's always instructive to go to other cultures where time mm-hmm. is very different. Mm-hmm. And I think that's a helpful thing. I know we had an African woman who lived with us while she went to college, and then she took us on a tour back to her home. And after we'd been with her for about 2 weeks, we realized she was going to stay afterwards, that she was going to have to spend a great deal of time rebuilding bridges with people that she, in order to follow our sense of time, she was insulting people all along the way.
Oh,
uh-huh, uh-huh. Because she would run into a friend and she, where in her society, she would have taken whatever time it took to catch up on those people, mm-hmm. because she had 12 of us Americans. She would just keep going,
mm-hmm.
and it took us those 2 weeks to figure out all the work she had to do to mm-hmm. make up for abiding by our sense of time within uh-huh. her culture.
Uh-huh. Yeah. That's interesting. Anybody? Yes?
Well, little children that come from low social economic, when they start school, don't have a sense of time, mm-hmm. and we teachers get real uptight because they come in late, mm-hmm. they don't go to bed on time,
mm-hmm.
And we think, why don't they live by the clock? Why don't mm-hmm. they do what the rest of us mm-hmm. do? Why aren't they more
mm-hmm.
structured?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and it's a real disadvantage to them in the school system,
yeah.
also, isn't it? Yeah. Yeah. Okay. Well, let's. Let's proceed. I think that some of the things we're talking about here are especially acute in our fast-paced technological society. But actually, some of them also have deep, long-term enduring human origins. The and here, the Christian practice, what I call Christian practices that we have received to help us live well in time, to notice what time it is, in a sense, what time is, what's happening in time as we move through these days, received from Judaism, most of them, you know, are very ancient. And I think the important thing is, I hope that we will get to some ideas that can help us to have some peace and some orientation within the midst of the bustle and the crush. But also, these ways of living in time, they're important not just because they help us get our calendar straight, they're also important because they teach us over and over and over who we are, who God is, what is the Christian story. So listen for that as we go through these. One of my favorite stories about time comes from a comment that Martha made when she was 3 and a half or so, one morning at the breakfast table. Mommy, what time is it? And I said, well, it's 7 o'clock. No, what time is it? Well, it's time for Sesame Street. It's morning. It's breakfast time. No. She said, Halloween all finished, Christmas all finished, Valentine's all finished, what time is it? Okay. There's a certain way in which knowing what time it is draws us into community, right? And that happens in every culture, but also teaches us stories and teaches us what time is full of, right? And the liturgical year, just mentioned, is something that teaches us the Christian story over and over again, right, as we live into its rhythms. The point is, people love the variety and the colors and the change, and I do too. But the real point is to become united to that story ourselves too as we live through it. And let me just point out a couple of resources from the books that are in the bookstore that, for those of you interested in exploring that further, Susan Briel did a retreat called Praying the Seasons of Our Lives, a little booklet with prayers and dialogues and graphics. And her proposal here is that in the course of our individual lives, we have times that are kind of Lenten, and times that are Easter times for us, times that are times of waiting. And they may not exactly coincide with what the whole church is doing this particular week, okay? So that when my Lenten time might come right on Pentecost, as far as the church is concerned, but that the experience of having lived with the people of God through the Lenten season will come to me as a memory and as a reality that I can then experience whenever my own Lenten season is. So I would recommend that for personal devotions or for group study. Another book, which is quite a few years old, but which I've always really liked, is by Gertrude Mueller Nelson, To Dance with God: Family Ritual and Community Celebration. And she just gives ideas for bringing especially the liturgical year into your home, and often with children, but not just then. And stories and things to make and ways to think about how time changes in the course of a year. And these are both in the bookstore. There are lots of copies. So that's one of the practices. Anybody want to comment on that one? Should we charge on ahead to practice it? And again, not just to enjoy the beauty of it, though we do, but to allow it to change us as we move through our stories. Another set of practices, I think, cling to the shape of the day. You know, days are the kind of the smallest natural, real piece of time that there is, created by nature. You know, and until 200 or 300 years ago, an hour was 1/12th of the time between sunrise and sunset, no matter where you were on the globe, what season it was. So sometimes in clock time, you know, in our clocks, hours were really short, and sometimes they were really long, and it wasn't regular. So hours, in other words, are human constructs. But days are real. I mean, days are right there in the turning of the earth. And it seems to me that's a pretty good length of time for, you know, to see your life as a whole, but also to be able to look back and reflect on it. So lots of traditions of prayer in Judaism and Christianity cling to the length of the day. Okay, morning prayer, evening prayer. Lots of people have patterns of this kind. As we go into a 24-hour society where days may make less difference, and how do we find ways to hold on to some sense that days are real and to give thanks each day? One tradition that's very, that I find very powerful is the idea of the bedtime as the time when we really give ourselves over to God, to God's keeping, when we acknowledge our mortality, our frailty, and our vulnerability, and hope that God and other people will watch over us as we sleep. You know, there's a little bit of dying in that, a little bit of acknowledging our mortality. Anybody want to comment on this one before we go to Sally? Well, the Sabbath's the one that was announced as the one we talk about. The practice of keeping one day as a day of rest and worship, which of course began in Judaism and which is sustained as a very important continuing part of the Jewish people's covenant with God as the seventh day. Historically, through a whole series of developments that aren't necessary to review, the Christian church came to, almost universally, came to absorb the Sabbath into its weekly celebration of Christ's resurrection on the first day of the week. So that, which is controversial, but which I think is a good way of sort of expressing our continuity with Judaism while also expressing the difference. It's a long tradition by now of kind of putting, having the weekly celebration of the Lord's Day and the resurrection of Jesus, which every Sunday, you know, is another Easter celebration. And Christian people have been, well, people who followed Jesus have been gathering to celebrate that day every week since the day of resurrection itself, I believe. So it's that day to claim that freedom of resting and worshiping is a strong part of the Christian heritage. Now, here we are in a situation where that's very difficult, right? Because of the changes in the economy, all the changes that we've been talking about. But I think it's worth I would want to argue, without making this something that makes people feel even more guilty than they might otherwise, okay? And with presenting Sabbath keeping as a gift rather than as a burden, say, you know, here is a ready-made tradition for your life, for our lives, which we ought to be helping one another to receive gratefully. You don't have enough time, you're too stressed, you don't get enough rest. Well, you don't have to make up the answer. You don't have to make up the response. There is a response that comes to us from a long and rich past, and it is there for us to celebrate and receive. And again, it's not just a matter of getting rest. There's in the content, theological content of taking this day in itself, there's some acknowledgement of who we are and whose we are that's very powerful, I think. To say that, you know, and the reasons that the Jewish people kept Sabbath are also reasons that we ought to keep our different Sabbath, because God created the world in 6 days, and on the seventh God rested and made it holy, and it's one of the reasons for keeping Sabbath. Let's just try to remember who created the world. Who keeps it spinning? Who causes the grain to grow, right? It's not us. And so there's a worship. I think there's an act of worship in taking this day in itself. The other reason given in Jewish scripture for keeping Sabbath, because this is right as an appendix within the Ten Commandments itself, because the Lord your God led you out of Egypt with a mighty hand. Therefore, you shall keep Sabbath. And you shall see to it that all of your servants, even your livestock, all the people who dwell with you, even if they're aliens, shall also have a day of rest. Okay? So there's an act of, there's some liberation theology built into this. Okay, there's some social justice, a claim that God is against slavery built into this. Okay? The slavery that was imposed on the Hebrew people and that is still imposed on many others. And also I think this, whatever slavery might impose upon ourselves, right, by our sense of indispensability and so on. And then of course to have this combined with the day of resurrection, when we're saying life is stronger than death, and we believe that. You know, we're not justifying ourselves. If we believe in Easter, we don't have to justify ourselves by how much we work, how big our appointment books are, and so on. We are justified by someone else, right? So there's the sense that there's a social sense that we need this rest, and we do. There also is a theology built into it, especially when that is named and claimed and celebrated in Christian worship, as it is in our churches on Sundays. But I think shows that this is not just about resting, it's also about becoming who God means us to be. And I would say that about all three of the practices that I've described. This is about acknowledging who God is and becoming who God means us to be. Okay? And my hope is that these, you know, observing these patterns, receiving them as the gift from the tradition that they are, can help us to form little communities of resistance, not to throw out our date books altogether, not to necessarily never miss a morning prayer, never miss a Sunday at church or whatever, but rather to become communities of resistance that see time differently than the commercial, let's master it, let's deny we're immortal culture in which we live. So let's talk about this a minute, and then we can go into some practical ideas for actually keeping Sabbath. Any responses to the theological ideas or the basic reading? You can object to.
This is another culture, but we were in Greece and Turkey a few months ago, and I was impressed with the minarets and the call, because it gave a pattern and a focus from an entirely different culture, that there was a different kind of a time.
Yeah, thank you. Right, and it orders the society. And you know, and there are Muslims in the United States who still stop at those times of day, right? With far less social support than most of us have we know Sunday's getting harder and harder to keep. But it's much harder to be Muslim in this culture than Christian. And yet there's a sense of being a community of resistance, which I kind of admire. I think the same with Orthodox Jews who really keep Shabbat from Friday night to Saturday night. They'll just tell, you know, I know very people with very responsible jobs who just tell employers right at the beginning, well, you just have to know I'm going to keep Shabbat. Okay. Mm-hmm. Right? I mean, there's a certain, if there's a clarity on the part of the person, and I should add, not just on the part of the person, but a community that holds that person still to account, which is what we may be lacking in many Christian.
I'm kind of curious, as to the people who are in there, the social support that exists for all in your community to keep time sacred or to keep the Sabbath holy.
Yeah.
Yes, Bob.
Yeah, Bob.
Go for it.
Sorry.
I was just going to say, we have a friend who, we have one of our former pastors, Stan Olson, who's now the bishop in southwestern Minnesota, has a daughter who just finished her second year in medical school in Duluth, and she just got a major write-up in the St. Paul Pioneer Press because as a result of coming to Holden about three years ago probably, she decided to keep the Sabbath holy and not study on Saturday, on Sunday. Mm-hmm. And that's not easy to do in medical school.
Mm-hmm.
And she rigidly did this for 2 years and showed, actually her grades went up. She moved up in a class. But on Sunday, she used Sunday to attend church, pray, maybe cross-country ski.
Uh-huh.
And they thought it was so unusual.
Uh-huh.
People couldn't believe that she was actually taking a day of the week.
Uh-huh.
And, and they wrote it up, and she actually got the idea by coming here.
Uh-huh, uh-huh, great. Yeah, I found for myself, now we'll get to yours, I think yours probably has a lot to do with kids and activities, too. For myself, as a person in education, biblical days begin when? At dusk. Okay, and it was evening and it was morning, the first day, and it was okay, for me, if I think of this as Saturday evening to Sunday evening, like Saturday supper to Sunday supper, and I know that I'm going to be able to just really, you know, do a lot of work on Sunday night, without which I could never get into my week, it does make the whole day feel much more joyful. Okay, so this, and that's for, and I think that's true for my kids now that they're in high school also, that we know that Sunday evening is a time when we can really kind of.
So you contextualize it from Saturday night to Sunday mm-hmm. at 7.
Well, after supper, just after supper. When we're done with supper. Yeah, yeah. And it's not even that explicit, but that's the way I think of it. Now, that was just a real breakthrough for me to not have to stay all the way to bedtime on Sunday. I don't know what this medical student did.
No, I think she does. I think it's the whole day.
Yeah. Well, this was a whole day in a different sense.
Yeah.
I think that adapt, figuring out what will work is important, and really in groups of people as well. Yeah.
We're, being in this post-Christian age, we seem surprised that culture doesn't want to bend, accommodate a Christian schedule, and we're mm-hmm. shocked that stores are open, and and you made the reference to our Jewish brothers and sisters, they didn't seem to complain a lot that things went on Friday night and Saturday day,
mm-hmm.
and so there is a question of being a community of resistance going, Sabbath became much more important in exile than it ever was during the kingdom.
Right.
So this exile community has to do something to pull itself together for mm-hmm. us to start, okay, then maybe soccer on Sunday morning, we won't play that day. That's just
mm-hmm.
if we're,
mm-hmm.
whatever those choices are.
Mm-hmm.
But now, we didn't have to make those choices before. They were made for us. Culture accommodated. Now that it won't, we're whining about it.
Right. And I think it's the perfect sort of case for practicing up for some other kinds of resistance. It's a good case for, learning to live a little bit against the grain of culture. You're right, and biblically, almost all the biblical texts that refer to Sabbath are associated with the, not all by any means, but it gives a much stronger theme after the exile. And Abraham Joshua Heschel, a great rabbinic author about Judaism, writes that it's because the Jewish people did not have a place, they needed a time. And yes, Richard.
In the early days of Holden, Caroline Doyle would stress it's not fair that teachers have a sabbatical. Everybody ought to have a sabbatical.
Mm-hmm.
And
mm-hmm.
we've been working on that ever since. Take a year off from what we're doing.
Yes.
And come up here and spend a year, and you can do it entirely different.
Uh-huh.
And I argue, too, that you could do something with the economy if there were 8 people for 7 jobs. A person can take off a year and somebody replaces you with your job, is there when you get back. If you do that in groups of lawyers, doctors, I think it'd help a lot of people.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Take that year off and do something entirely different. Jabbering to them. And I think we should encourage that. And we are having people spending Europe here do something entirely different.
Right. It takes real courage at this in this economy and this society, doesn't it? It takes courage. But if we're thinking about it, I think that the people who have the courage to live in that way often live into a sense of fullness of who God is, who they are, what life is about. You know,
we have four doctors who've been here to be a good steward for 6 years, and you can afford to take off. You know, we'll come up here, and the ones that doctors that have been here said, I want to be a carpenter, a gardener. I want to do what I do. And the doctor came in today, and he's going to take off a year. He said, I'm not going to hold it illegal. I'm going to do something different. Changing what you're doing and try to decide, what are your priorities? What are you living for? What's real in life? Is it money? Or something like that.
Right. Even academics who take sabbaticals now often feel just as much pressure because they have to get that book done or whatever.
Right.
As it, not to complain, it's still a great gift, but still, it's, you know, it's not the same, it's not a context of freedom. Ellen, yes?
I just wanted to, Gertrude Pigger, to thought in the early days of Holden, after lunch, there was always a quiet hour.
Really?
And people would sit on the porches, and even the children were encouraged to do quiet activities. And it was just a peace in the whole village. So that we got the busyness.
So why did that change?
I don't know. Do you remember that, Gertrude?
Yes. And it was sit under the tree by the back.
Well, it was a time of prayer.
Prayer.
Nobody had to go to it. He wanted to go to the job and he did it.
We still resist certain kinds of programming from 1:45 to 3:45, certain kinds. But there's pressure. A lot of newcomers to Holden will come in, let's say you arrive on a Saturday, go to something on Saturday night, get up Sunday, and there's this empty day. And it's very hard for some people to do that. I also want to mention those people in the village and also at home who are serving others on the Sunday, like these two, like pastors, right? Church musicians and all kinds of other people, right? And the way I've come to think about that is this is where I draw on some of Jesus' sayings about the Sabbath and some of the healing on the Sabbath and so on. That, but in Matthew, the close, when Jesus is the place where he says, Sabbath was not made for man, but the man, somebody say it here, man was
not made for the Sabbath.
The Sabbath was made for man. Okay.
Or human.
Humankind, right. And shortly thereafter he says, come unto me, all you that labor, and I will give you rest. And he's being presented as the Sabbath himself. But to say that the Sabbath is made for humankind is still a good thing. But that there are some who are called to make Sabbath for others, in a sense, to offer, to give themselves, it's sort of a self-giving love.
Well, nurses have to experience that all the time.
Nurses, that's right.
You're on duty, and you're serving others.
Right, nurses.
Which means you have to carve out another time, you just have to be creative.
That's right, and the rest of the community needs to see these people are out of self-giving love, giving us Sabbath. And we want to honor them and make sure that we have to insist that they get that other day for themselves.
Yeah. But you know, part of what I continue to be reminded of is how our memories are flawed. And we receive gift, but we very quickly turn it into demand.
For those of us
that grew up in the 50s, we were coming through a time when our piety was presented in such a way that Sunday was a gift. Sunday was demanded abstinence. So coming into the 60s and 70s, it just made sense for us to try to fill it up more because it had been withheld from us with no really helpful teaching. Well-intentioned, God-fearing people with Jesus in their heart screwed it up.
I was going to say,
Mike Acanelli, this one thing that he says, he's a youth speaker, and he said, the church is so good at filling their days with committee meetings, and he says, committees never changed anything. He says some, you know, really radical thing would be for churches to cancel every meeting for 1 week and see what happens, because you know, you can spend hours in a meeting, and we all have been there, and nothing has happened.
And he's saying that now.
Yeah, he's
as a new emphasis after after years of sort of let's keep those youth busy.
Well, he's saying that for everything.
Yes,
that's
he's
what
he's saying that for a long time.
Yeah. Right, he's saying that now as a kind of.
No, he's been saying Sabbath for all for over about a decade. Yeah.
Okay.
Right. Misinterpreted.
Okay, good. No, I meant to praise him for doing it.
Oh, yeah.
But there's
but
there is a sense that even in youth ministry, you want to keep everybody busy, you know, and keep them entertained, and that, well, otherwise they'll be killing time. If we haven't got it mastered, you know, they won't know what to do with it. Yeah, Joan.
Three things. Mm-hmm. A group that I've been praying with every Thursday night for about 10 years helped each other keep Sabbath as our Lenten discipline 1 year. And the guidelines we used were no work, no worry, no commerce. Mm-hmm. So each week we'd ask each other how it go. When was your time of no work, no worry, no commerce?
Mm-hmm. Right.
And then, before we got married.
and Dan Erlander's description of Sabbath is time for friendship with God, with self, with nature, with one another.
Mm-hmm. Great.
That's another way to define what the Sabbath times are. And third, at our church, we're playing with the idea of having a Sabbath year where we get together but without agendas. And our reason for getting together will be to appreciate each other, for friendship with God, with one another, with nature. We haven't done it yet, but we're thinking about it.
No, I know several churches that have done that. I know one church that had, was doing its whole mission planning, like, strategic plan, and they just all, somebody said, I feel so tired, this makes me feel so tired. And they just took off a year, you know, and prayed, and, so, and then they next year they did it, and it was a different experience. And I also know some judicatories, for instance, synods or conferences, I know two in the United Church of Christ that simply said, we're not having any meetings this year, everybody's worn out. And, you know, then they picked up again, but maybe even may have them appreciate the seeing one another more regularly in the subsequent year. So, yeah.
Well, the I find it distressing the scheduling of hockey and soccer on Sunday morning. Mm-hmm. And, you know, what would that take? Because if you say, you know, our family's going to church, that really makes your kids suffer. So, you, like some of you have struggled with this, you almost have to get a few of you at least to kind of,
yeah.
It's ice time and all this, you know, and I say, there's no other way.
Right. Well, I was doing a workshop like this with one pastor told me that, I think he was in Canada, that the churches had gotten together and formed an alternate hockey league. Which only was on Saturdays then, and which had become the best league in that relatively small town because so many people were involved. I think that some of the initiatives that have churches offering worship at a number of times are not a bad thing. Especially if you have this image of the a biblical day going from dusk to dusk. Mm-hmm. And at Holden we do Sunday evening, which in technical biblical terms might not be, you know, exactly right. But I mean, I think that some kinds of, that as long as there's a weekliness and there's a clear temporal link to the celebration of Christ's resurrection, I'm not opposed to, I don't think that 11 o'clock Sunday morning is the only theologically proper time for Eucharistic weekly Lord's Day worship. Okay. So that some of the initiative that's being taken is an experimentation, I think, is a good thing. Anne?
I hadn't thought of this, but one of the things that our church had started talking about was Saturday night worship, but also having Wednesday night worship. And what they were accommodating were blended families. where there were alternate weekends, and that the family wanted the child to only have maybe one church that they needed to affiliate with. Mm-hmm. So they would go Sunday, Wednesday, or go Wednesday all the time with it, which to me, I hadn't thought through those issues at the time, too, when they talk about families that are trying to figure out ways to accommodate. Or not blended families, I guess you would say families with parents in two different families.
Right. What do you do with the schools that have all the sports? I mean, we always used to have Sunday off, and now they schedule tournaments on Sunday morning. Do you take your kids off the team?
Is that happening?
They have to suffer the consequences. What do you do as a society for that?
I have not experienced that yet. But although we do, we have allowed our kids to do, there have been times when they have missed church because of some kind of event.
An alternative.
Yeah. But you can sit around and stew because there are, several times in a year that it's not going to work without just claiming with great joy the other 48, So, and that's kind of what we do in our family. There have been a few school trips or academic competitions. They'll be off somewhere. And it's too bad, but it's not, we don't fuss about it. Sometimes, now, we haven't done this year, but in the past, often we would just sort of put a tape of Holden Vespers on after supper on Sunday and sing that together. Read the day's readings as a way of just acknowledging that this has been the Lord's day. We're going into a new week. It does disturb me if that week's lessons haven't passed our consciousness. That bothers me a lot. But we may all have our different ways of negotiating this. I think that, John mentioned the way in which this so easily became demand, law, abstinence. I hold the reformers accountable. Now, right before the Reformation in the Middle Ages, there were 200 days a year in Europe that were saints' days or Sundays or something. And of course, the Reformation came along right at the same time that capitalism was getting going. And to get people on a regular 6-1-6-1 was a pretty, it was pretty neat. And also, since religion was kind of in flux at that time, they really leaned hard on this is the day for church. And church all day, and that was what was important. And the other parts of Sabbath keeping, friendship with one another, with nature, those parts were not emphasized at all. And I think that became very embedded in the confessional Reformed and Lutheran traditions. But that we're, that's behind us for good and for ill, I suppose. I think that to really look again at the biblical theology of time and to allow these practices, which are just there waiting to be received, to lead us into not only a better way of living in time, but also to remind us weekly and daily and yearly who we are and that this project of mastery that our culture is about is not really true.
Well, one of the practices that were mandated for me growing up was Sunday drives. Huh. We went for Sunday drives, and we did something that we called visiting. Where you went to another person's house and just stayed for a while and usually ate something.
They were staying Canadian.
Was there a covered dish involved? I just wanted to know.
In jello, cookies and coffee.
Well, we need to bring this to an end because we do have clock time here at Holden as well. But thank you very much for coming, and I hope there are other ideas you want to share among yourselves or informally, please do. Thank you very much.
Thank you.